African universities need Asian studies programs like yesterday. It's almost an emergency, you know, really. It's incredibly important.
You're listening to The Commute, your new favorite podcast, and I'm Jessica Van Onselen. I had to resist titling today's podcast, How's It My China?, a piece of slang only South Africans will understand. Why did I have to resist? Because adulting. But the topic of today is nevertheless China and South Africa. I was lucky enough to travel to China in 2011 and have never been able to stop thinking about its complexity and history and its rock-solid faith that it's one of the greatest countries in human civilization. Because our media reporting in South Africa tends towards the insular, or our domestic affairs just feel so overwhelming, whichever way you prefer to think about it, we don't often discuss China in South Africa, except maybe in the context of the BRICS partnership, an economic bloc made up of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. See, it spells BRICS. But there's actually been a hell of a lot going on with China recently. Last year, in 2017, China announced a $900 billion infrastructure investment initiative called One Belt, One Road. Let's just go over that slowly. Firstly, the figure of $900 billion. That is an almost incomprehensibly huge amount of money. It's like the figure Dudazane Zuma puts on his financial goals motivational vision board. It's just huge. Secondly, One Belt, One Road isn't exactly the most catchy title, although in Chinese it's Yi Dai Yi Lu, and that is significantly cooler to say, I do admit. So the Chinese initiative refers to building an economic belt, that's the belt, along the old Silk Road trading routes, that's the road, which used to connect Beijing to Europe. One Belt, One Road was announced by China's president, Xi Jinping, who also stands to benefit from China's recent decision, just a few weeks ago, to abolish term limits, giving him the potential to be president for life. What does that mean for us down here in South Africa? If anything. Since watching Donnie J. Trump is like watching America do a belly flop in slow-mo into the Banana Republic swimming pool, people are increasingly wondering if Xi Jinping is going to save us all. Can he lead us on climate change, trade, security, loans, infrastructure, North Korea? Fortunately, in an excellent bit of foresight, South Africa has been sucking up to China for years, and also taking loans from China for years. To find out more, I got on the phone with Dr. Kobus van Staden from the South African Institute of International Affairs. I came across Kobus because I'm a huge fan of his podcast, which is called the China Africa Podcast. Please go and subscribe. It's just a really great show full of amazing insights and research on China and Africa. Kobus completed his PhD in Japanese studies and media studies at the University of Nagoya in Japan in 2008, and his work focuses on China-Africa relations through the China-Africa Project. Before we start the interview, I need to mention that the line was a little sticky in one or two places on the call. Sorry about that. It's not your dirty earphones, it's me. But hopefully you won't even notice. Right, let's go, my China. Kobus van Staden, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So 2018 marks the 20th anniversary of South Africa-China relations. Could you give us an overview of South Africa-China relations over the last couple of decades? I mean, that might cover, I imagine, trade or BRICS. We also know there's some ideological ties between the ANC and the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, what does the listener need to know?
There's a lot. It's a big relationship. South Africa is China's key partner in Africa. The relationship runs over a broad range of issues. China is South Africa's largest trade partner, so it's a really important economic relationship for South Africa. It is a major investor in South Africa, but it's not by far the largest investor in South Africa. Like, the largest investors are still Western investors. But in terms of trade, China buys a lot of stuff from us, and we buy a lot of stuff from China. We import more than we export. And then also, it's a growing and increasingly important political relationship for both sides, because they kind of are on the same page ideologically in some kind of ways, and for that reason, South Africa is a key partner in Africa for China. South Africa has been upgraded quite several times, in the partnership has been upgraded to the extent that, you know, that South Africa is now a BRICS member, thanks to China, China like did the work of getting South Africa into that bloc. They are kind of hosting summits together. You know, the BRICS summit, for example, is happening this year in South Africa. And, you know, so on a bunch of diplomatic levels, they are, the relationship is getting stronger and stronger. You know, so it is important, I think, to start unpacking the complexity of the relationship, because I think it is one of China's most complex relationships in Africa.
And why do you say complex? Is that because of the sophistication of the South African economy, of our political landscape, of China's ambitions?
Yes, all of those. Our economy is more sophisticated and more complicated than lots of other African countries. So even though some of the patterns that China has with the rest of Africa are repeated in South Africa, there's a whole bunch of exceptions in the South African case as well. So, for example, like, you know, in many places, China's main involvement with African countries are in extraction and infrastructure provision. In the case of South Africa, there's a whole big, you know, kind of Chinese investment in banking, for example. You know, so the South African banking sector is important for Africa and China. It's important for China and Africa. I mean, you know, South Africa is also a lot more complicated in ways that other African countries are not. So, for example, South Africa's legal and labor landscapes are a lot more complicated and a lot more of a handful to China than other African countries. Like, for example, our unions are a lot more powerful, you know, which complicates Chinese investment in South Africa. So in a lot of ways, the complexity of South Africa also, you know, makes the relationship more complex.
Okay, so you mentioned obviously the extractive dimension of the trade relationship being critical, South Africa being mineral rich, China needing to drive a lot of its growth with minerals, also infrastructure provision. But there is another aspect, which is that China is a significant issuer of loans into Africa, well, all over the world, but in this particular case, into Africa. And South Africa has actually taken significant loans from the Chinese. I was just looking into this a bit. I mean, in July 2017, our dear beleaguered Eskom signed a 20.2 billion rand loan agreement with the China Development Bank. That's part of the Medupi power plant financing. And that was on top of an earlier 7.2 billion rand loan that they borrowed in December 2015, which is all well and good. But then I saw with horror that in December, Sri Lanka actually had to hand over one of its national ports to the Chinese because of their inability to service loans that they'd taken from the Chinese. And Zambia now finds itself in a similar position, overextended with loans to the Chinese. So, Kobus, is China a scary creditor? I mean, should South Africa be scared?
I think Africa as a whole should be concerned about this issue. The case of Sri Lanka, you know, resonated right through Africa. I think it raised a lot of anxieties in Africa, and there's a lot of discussion in Africa at the moment about debt sustainability. Of course, Africa, you know, was significantly traumatized by debt in the past. You know, when runaway debt took over in the 70s and 80s, the Bretton Woods institutions, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, impose a set of structural adjustment programs, which you know, set African growth back decades, and led to widespread social disruption in Africa. So Africa is scared of debt for a good reason, and I think it should be cautious in this case as well. But at the same time, Africa is kind of in a bind, you know, because it needs infrastructure, and without infrastructure, it's not going to develop. If you look at the case of Ethiopia, for example, the infrastructure that was provided via Chinese loans is actually leading to significant economic growth. And so the Chinese themselves have said that, you know, well, you know, sorry, but, you know, if you are taking this infrastructure-led and manufacturing-led growth model that we got rich on, then being super indebted for a while is part of the deal. You know, which you know, kind of got sort of like muted, like, you know, harming and awing in Africa. I think they kind of have a point. That doesn't, you know, lessen the danger. I think the issues, the danger to African sovereignty is real. And I think it is important, you know, to keep an eye on debt sustainability. But of course, I mean, China isn't the only lender. I mean, you can get yourself in trouble with lots of different lenders. So, you know, so it's a wider principle. At the same time, you also sit with first world economies like the US being deeply indebted to China, you know, so in certain ways, it's almost difficult to not be indebted to China. In the case of South Africa, I don't think South Africa is in such a kind of hectic position as a country like Zambia. Also because South Africa has a, you know, has significant, kind of checks and balances, in relation to these issues. However, obviously, corruption in South Africa is a big issue. And South Africa faces similar kind of pressures in terms of needing to upgrade infrastructure networks, needing that, like, connect, you know, like a sustainable, like dependable high-speed rail connection between Durban and Gauteng, for example. I mean, there's just no way around that. You know, you just need it. If you want to grow beyond a certain level, then you're going to have to spend that money. So it, you know, there isn't that much room to maneuver if you also want to develop and grow.
So something that's made a lot of headlines has been the recent changes to the Chinese constitution, the abolishment of term limits that have made Xi Jinping arguably the most powerful man in the world right now. But we don't, as South Africa, we don't really talk about Xi's leadership a lot. He isn't really front and center of our newspapers, perhaps the way he is in Europe and the States. Could you tell us a little bit more about him? He seems much more assertive than his predecessors. Who is Xi and what can we expect under him?
Well, you know, he is a little bit of an enigma, as is a lot of internal Chinese Communist Party dynamics. But from what we know, Xi is really, really grew up within the party. Like you say, his parents were very significant party functionaries. And he was one of the group of party elite children who, you know, kind of who was kind of very early on trained in party ideology very deeply. And, you know, there's all of these kind of famous pictures of him, you know, having been sent to, you know, in the 70s, sent out to the rural areas to live there with farmers, which was a big thing during the Cultural Revolution, where the city elite, and especially the city elite's children, were kind of like packed off to extremely rural areas to, quote, learn from the peasantry. And he did that. So he is, you know, he is someone who really came up through the party. And one of the things that has been very clear in this changeover is that he really is, I mean, the party is front and central in Chinese politics for, you know, since the revolution, but he really, really is reinforcing party power. He's making the party a lot more powerful. So that is, you know, that is interesting. He also has a lot he's a lot more controlling, I think, or a lot more assertively controlling of, you know, of a whole bunch of party mechanisms. So, for example, his crackdown on corruption, a lot of people have characterized that as also a way of shoring up his political support and eliminating enemies. But he did put the party on this kind of direction of being completely central to the society in China, everything running via the party. There's no clear distinction between the party and the state. And because the term limits have been abolished, that vision is going to be dominant for a while. So it really is a good idea for Africa to get to know Xi a lot better, and also to get to know the Chinese party, communist system and political system a lot better. Like, African universities need Asian studies programs like yesterday. It's almost an emergency, you know. Really, it's incredibly important. But in terms of how she is gonna go from here, that is obviously the $1 billion question that everyone is, you know, trying to think about. But it's very difficult to actually get real answers because the system in China is frequently so opaque.
And there was a sort of a moment of hope, I think, when Donald Trump was elected and then Brexit was passed in the UK, that Xi might start to provide the leadership, certainly on big issues like globalism and climate change. He might step into the breach, which might have been left there by Europe and United States at sort of stepping back. But then there was the abolition of term limits, and I'm wondering, are there indications that this person might have authoritarian tendencies? I mean, clearly the Chinese Communist Party is in very many ways textbook authoritarian, but might he take a harder line on power than some of his immediate predecessors?
Well, he does seem to really be taking, you know, a harder line. There's a lot of crackdowns in China around a lot of different issues. So, you know, I think Chinese authorities themselves would probably acknowledge that. So, within China, a lot of it is couched in terms of making the system more efficient and also making it less corrupt. Mm-hmm. And I mean, China has had significant corruption problems over the last few decades. So it's not like the corruption issue isn't, it's just a red herring. But yeah, I mean, he has considerably like firmer grip on the controls, I think, than previous leaders. That, for me, doesn't necessarily eliminate the idea that China might take on a global leadership role. I think both of those could happen at the same time. Because the US is so divided on key issues, climate change being a really good example, China does, I think, I've seen numbers that China has the highest investment in renewable energy in the world. And China has a very strong domestic pressure to clean up their environment. It's one of the biggest, kind of hot button issues in China. It's this kind of perfect situation where Chinese leaders are facing domestic pressure and an opportunity to lead internationally, you know? So I think there is a chance there that China could actually move towards, playing a bigger role in climate change, playing a bigger role in multilateralism generally, because the US is so divided and kind of befuddled around these issues at the moment.
In this sense, South Africa might be well positioned because, in fact, they have been cultivating a strong relationship with China for decades, perhaps more so than some of their peer countries. So in 2017, Xi announced really the sort of jewel in the crown. He announced this signature initiative of his time in power so far, which was called the One Belt, One Road Initiative. I had a little look at it sort of researching for this podcast. I couldn't really see Africa or South Africa in it. But for our listeners, could you just explain, when they hear about One Belt, One Road, what is it and what does it involve?
It's a very big infrastructure rollout that is designed it's difficult to discuss it without sounding grandiose, but it essentially is designed to use infrastructure to connect China mostly to Western Europe through kind of massive infrastructure rollouts. So the kind of bigger idea of it would be that it's a form of kind of remaking the old Silk Road system, which obviously was an international trade route that had Beijing at the center. So the idea is that there's two routes. One is called the Silk Road Economic Belt, which runs overland through Central Asia, through parts of the Middle East, to Europe, to Germany, and then through interlinked train lines. It's essentially long train lines. But there's a lot of other infrastructure there too, a lot of data networks and oil pipelines and so on is also built along that route. The second one is essentially a series of ports, which is called the 21st Century Maritime Silk Road. And that is, it runs through Southeast Asia, through the sea. It's a series of seaports and shipping lanes running through Southeast Asia, past South Asia, and then to Mombasa. So it touches Africa in Kenya. There's also another rail line connecting Ethiopia to Djibouti. And Djibouti is also the location of China's first overseas military base. So it's an important also military base. So those are these kind of connections on the East African coast that then facilitate shipping, keeping shipping safe from piracy, for example, through the Suez Canal and to the Mediterranean. So it has the potential of connecting large parts of the interior of East Africa, and even Central Africa if the rail lines extended that far, to this, you know, kind of halfway around the world kind of massive trading route.
The concentration on East Africa and building or rebuilding those sort of sophisticated infrastructure links into Western Europe and Asia, that by necessity omits South Africa. Do you think that's a lost opportunity for South Africa, or do you think there's enough other trade relations and cooperative arrangements to compensate for exclusion from One Belt, One Road?
I don't think that South Africa is actually 100% excluded from it. Like, there's recently a big new undersea internet cable that was laid between Kenya and Pakistan, and in Pakistan it connected to cables that, you know, that connect to China. So it's done by Chinese companies, and it's a Chinese kind of internet provision initiative, and so it connected to Nigeria, to Kenya, I mean, and but at the same time it was. The next phase two of that project was going to connect it to Egypt on the one side and then to South Africa on the other side. So I think there is the potential for South Africa to get some profit out of this, you know, kind of by focusing on corridors that run up the eastern seaboard of the African continent. So South Africa would need to integrate in creative ways with Mozambique, which would then connect it to Tanzania, and Tanzania is already building a bunch of Belt and Road related infrastructure. There's big new ports happening in Tanzania. So it's not necessary that it's only the countries that are on the official Belt and Road route. You already see that one of the countries that is making the most out of all of this development is actually Ethiopia, which is A, not even actually on the route, and B, not even on the sea. You know, it is connected to a port via a Chinese-built rail line to Djibouti. And Ethiopia has made a lot of investments in special economic zones, and it is using, you know, some of these kind of connections that are being set up to Europe to also export to Europe. And a lot of that is happening with Chinese money. So if South Africa is proactive about it, and if South Africa is, you know, kind of has a more integrated vision with the rest of East Africa, which is, you know, extremely necessary anyway, then there is the potential to gain some kind of traction from Belt and Road.
Perhaps almost returning to Mbeki's interest in the African continent, his sort of internationalism, perhaps the Ramaphosa presidency, if they have a more engaged foreign policy, there are some benefits for South Africa to reap from these sort of developments.
Yes, yes. I think, you know, the continental free trade zone, you know, is happening as we speak. And so there's a lot of opportunities there. I think the entire continent is kind of headed in that more integrative cross-frontier kind of direction. So, you know, I think the vision was coined by Mbeki and some of his work, but to a certain extent, you know, it is now, I think, much more of a mainstream agenda in Africa. And you know, I don't think South Africa is necessarily even really leading it at the moment. You know, it's just, but it would be good if it became a full partner in it.
So that's a fantastic overview. Thank you so much. You actually run your own podcast with a colleague of yours called the China Africa Podcast, which is how I came across you. I'm a huge fan. I think it's one of the most interesting and insightful podcast, which addresses a real gap in our knowledge, which is what is going on between China and Africa, underreported, underdiscussed area of the news. Tell us a little bit about the China Africa podcast and where listeners can find it.
Thank you so much. That's so kind. It's called the China and Africa podcast. It is on iTunes and all over the web. We do a lot of different kind of cross-platform work. So we run a news aggregator on social media. Our podcast, you know, has several partnerships. So we cross-post to a bunch of different outlets, and we try and cast the web as wide as possible. You know, so China Africa is a niche-y kind of topic. And it's, you know, so in certain ways, it is a narrow topic, but then within it, there is all of these kind of universes that you can explore. So we try and cast it as wide as possible and to try and get the conversation to go as wide as possible. So we have some people who are, some of our guests are extremely critical of China. Some of them, I guess, are extremely critical of Africa. Some of them are, you know, look at the relationship from the perspective of the West. Some are extremely critical of the West. It goes in that direction. So we tend to speak a lot with journalists and with academics because they focus so much on this work. But we also speak with a lot of people from NGOs, a lot of business people, a lot of students. We try and cast the net to include as many young people as possible. So we have, for example, even interviewed a Chinese high school student who was busy with a project in East Africa. So we try and show the full complexity of the topic.
One of the things I've really enjoyed about your podcast, being South African, our national monomania around race, there have been some really interesting conversations on the China and Africa podcast around Chinese racism. I won't get into it here, but I'd really like to say to listeners, if you are interested in exploring some of, you know, that really complex kind of issue of Chinese racism and how the Chinese are perhaps trying to confront that, the internal domestic conversations, go and listen to Kurvis's podcast on China and race. I mean, that's a fascinating topic, right, Kurvis?
Yes, and it's a very complex one. We have in the past, there's been over the last few months, there's been several race-related gaffes in China, you know, several kind of like media missteps that we pounced on with glee. But at the same time, the race in China is a very complicated situation. And, you know, so we have in the past done episodes with black people living in China, for example, where they discuss their experiences of racism there versus the experiences of racism in places like the UK or the US, for example. And unpacking how both those experiences of racism are experiences of racism, but also they are, you know, very different experiences of racism in lots of complicated ways. We also in the past have dealt with African racism against Chinese, which is a big issue, and I think it's an underexplored issue. And it's actually, you know, something in South Africa is actually, and in Africa as a whole, you know, like that is something that people are actually not as accustomed to unpacking. Lots of friends and acquaintances of Asian descent, East Asian descent, and also South Asian descent, in who live in Africa, make it very clear that you know, kind of racism, like anti-Asian racism in Africa, is very real. So we try and cover as much of that as possible, while also trying to acknowledge our own positions. You know, so we can never take on a position of being this like kind of voice of God commentator on the situation. We always have to make clear like where we come from, what our own experiences are, like what the role that white privilege plays in our lives, etc. You know, so it's always a kind of a complicated situation that we try and kind of, you know, make as complicated as possible.
It's just creating, I think, that platform for that conversation about these very tricky and under-discussed sort of topics. So listeners, I really would encourage finding the podcast. There's some really interesting stuff there to explore. And then Kurvis, just to end off with, I always ask my guests, so we have listeners who are in South Africa, but also in the expat community around the world. They've listened to this podcast. They want to know a little bit more about South Africa-Chinese relations. What would you recommend that they go, what resources would you recommend that they go and look for?
Two resources, actually. One is, this is a bit of log rolling for my own place of work, the South African Institute for International Affairs, which is where I'm an analyst. They have their website has a fantastic set of tools, and that is at saia.org.za. That's saia.org.za. And they have a whole bunch of tools related to China-Africa specifically, and then China-South Africa relations. There's a lot of it there. They are a very venerable think tank, and they were some of the earliest people who were focusing on China-Africa relations actually in the world. And then also the work and the accumulated archive of the Center for Chinese Studies at Stellenbosch University. I think it is at ccs.org.za. I think I'm not 100% sure. Probably Google that. They were also extremely early kind of adopters of the issue, and they have a massive kind of archive of work going back really a long time, like covering a lot of different China-Africa issues, but also deeply diving into China-South Africa issues.
Okay, fantastic. I will put those links into the show notes, listeners, so that you're able to access them. Kubis, thank you so much. It was absolutely fascinating, and we might have to have you back in a couple of months and have a catch-up on what's happened in China-South Africa relations. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I loved it. Thank you.
Check out www.thecommute.co.za for more episodes, or email me on thecommutesay@gmail.com if you have any comments or any ideas for series 2 of the podcast, or if you want me to interview you. Just kidding!